Thanks, George. Thanks to Song Alive. If I had my choice, we would not be in this formalized situation, but we'd be in my living room or something talking. I'm reflecting on the mindset that each of us brings to being here. Even the, you know, half hour guided meditation, half hour talk, half hour Q&A. So maybe we can loosen that up a little bit, because if we just go and sort of live out our own Buddhist cliches, I don't know if we'll really get done what we want to get done in our lives. I've been reflecting a lot about, in fact, what it is we're here to do. What is the Dhamma about? What is meditation practice about? And I try to get to the essentials, to the fundamental aspects of what's going on in this lived experience, like right now, as you sit here and listen to me as I speak. And I keep coming back to this refined, astonishing sensitivity of the organism. And this is what the Buddha was pointing to when he talked about the six sense bases, which was like a fundamental teaching. It's just like an elemental way of looking at the human experience to pull us out of those cliches, to pull us out of the way we fixate the world by our conditioning. So as you listen to me now, you know, there's the touch of my voice on your ear and the delicate vibrations that create this very intimate relationship through my voice and your hearing. So my words somehow appear in your mind right now, right? Seems like they're appearing on your computer monitor, your speakers, your headphones. They're appearing in your mind ultimately. Who cares if they're in your headphones? You could take those out and throw them away. It's the mind-to-mind contact and the sensitivity of this contact. That's what I'm talking about. And visually, the sensitivity. So the light from the monitor touching the eyes, and this incredibly rich signal, again, appears to the brain and blossoms into contact, visual contact, eye contact, it's called in the discourses, ear contact, eyes contact. And through language, these words that I'm speaking right now, touching through the ear contact is creating mind contact. So again, the sensitivity of this contact right now. So meditation, and we'll be silent in just a moment for those who are longing for the form. The meditation, the silent meditation, attunes us to that sensitivity, gives us an opportunity to pause out of the cliche of prior perceptions, out of the formed reactions that freeze the world to being, you know, kind of a unfortunate sty that it can sometimes be, and it opens us to the immediacy, which is where the beauty is, where the mystery is, and where we can understand the problems of this life in ourselves, in our hearts, between us relationally, and in all of these issues of race, gender, environment. It's all pivots on this sensitive point of contact and then the blossoming of the world. So with that in mind, it's sometimes good to simplify the sensory inputs. So I'll be speaking for guidance, but I'll be speaking less. And I recommend, if you're comfortable, that you also close your eyes. I will do the same. And so as the eyes close, you notice the visual contact is now, let's say, largely gray or black, or perhaps there's some orange in there. And notice that more neutral visual contact. Notice the sensitivity of the eyes, even when the eyes are closed, when the eyelids are lowered. The curiosity about this moment-by-moment contact. And noticing now ear contact. So there's this voice, this Gregory voice. But there's also whatever room sounds that you have. Traffic, heaters or coolers, animals, other people, room noise, machines, refrigerators. It's not silent, I can guarantee you that. If nothing else, you might hear some slight ringing in the ears. See what's actually here, not, oh, he's not talking, so there's nothing. So I'll pause and just listen. Ear contact. Sounds are known spontaneously. So sensitive. And there's this mind contact. As I speak and use words, ideas arise in your mind. When I invite you to look at your mind, to notice the formation of these words as I speak them to you, then perhaps you respond, perhaps you look inward. That's mind-to-mind contact. And then, of course, again, I'll pause. And you may notice the self-fabricated mind contact with, you know, your thoughts or feelings or just the constant bubbling up of personal history. So sensitive. Every contact can be known, rising and vanishing. Mind contact. And throughout all of this, sometimes perhaps for you in the foreground, sometimes in the background, if you're comfortable, you can notice body contact. Where do you notice it? where you have something, a sensation of touching a chair or a cushion, maybe a bed or a couch, noticing contact, sensitivity, constant vibrating sensitivity of the organism with touch. And all of the inner touches of the organs that you might feel, what your belly feels from your last meal or your last drink, all of the other residual noises of the body, the vibrating nervous system in a changing world. So sensitive. All the body contact, the flow, the rising and vanishing of those sensations, including the breath. Attuning to the sensitivity itself. Sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes it's unpleasant. The unpleasant might announce itself quite loudly. And if the mind is sensitive, the quality of attention is bright, you might direct it towards the neutral sensations, like those things that we might call legs or arms or your back, where you can notice the subtlety of sensation that is usually not noticed just because it's not so noisy. It's there. But we're always drawn to these louder things of pleasure and pain, pleasant and unpleasant. Can we notice the neutral in this delicate sensitivity of the organism? And noticing whatever sensation, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, whatever is most prominent right now, what is that? Something very big and, you might say, almost solid, like touching the chair, where the body touches the chair, or the hands touch or the feet touch, something most noticeable in a natural way right now. Noticing the sensitivity, the knowing of it, the vibrating up, the constant rising and vanishing of this feeling. And you might notice in the background some sense of my body, or even my body part, you know, like my stomach or my arms or hands, my torso. That's just a construct. It's a fabrication. Just drop down to the essence of contact, touch, the feeling itself. The habits of becoming a self out of this can be very strong, so don't be surprised if it keeps reforming. And the habits of perception, my body, and you jump into an internal image of your body, just noticing that. That's just simply a perception, which is fine. Come back to this bare sensitivity of sensing. The rising and vanishing of the feelings in the body. Contact, pasa in Pali, contact. Is a kind of relaxing into the flow of it that is invited more than trying to grab it or figure it out. It's a release of language, a release of image, concept, kind of a dropping down. To a bare simplicity. Of the organism. And if your experience is punctuated by thoughts or judgments or, you know, I can't get this or I really like this or any other things coming from the past or anything at all. That's the same exact sensitivity. It's just mind sensation. So don't worry about it at all. It's like, oh, that's mind, feeling, sensation. But give yourself the gift of, you don't have to follow that. There's an investigation, a curiosity of this phenomenological experience right now. Just this very thing. Contact, feeling, right here. So sensitive. I'm going to invite again a noticing of the larger acoustic field, the auditory field. So just let the attunement open wide out to hearing. So there's this voice, yes, but also all the sounds in your environment. Let the awareness get wide and open. Sounds touch the ear. Hearing arises. Contact. That sensitivity. You know where it is. So you're part of, you're in this acoustic field, rising and vanishing. Field of awareness. And let that field also include your whole body again. Not a particular point, but just the whole of the body. Just opening the field, just as you open it to sound. Sensitive, whole body. Opening wide. It's not a focused mind. It's an open mind. So there's the wide open field of hearing, the wide field of the body, so sensitive. And then just gently let the eyes open. Notice light touching the eyes. Contact arises. Light in general, the wide open visual field, vast auditory field, the field of the whole body, even as I speak, even as the eyes are open, sensing the whole body. So they're seeing and hearing, and the whole body. Open. Wide and open. Such a sensitive organism. And then if you happen to be looking at an image on a screen, you could notice that an image that it seems to be out there, but actually is arising in the mind. So noticing the image arising in the mind, but also the projection, oh, it's out there. Wonderful challenge. And it's all the vibrating of this sensitivity. Taking in information. An organism functioning in an environment. And so now noticing the specificity, the specific ah, there's Gregory, the sense internally of the responses, the sense of the body, seeing, hearing, and this thing out there, this Gregory, this human. And perhaps you can notice the responsiveness to this human as the body, as the feelings in the body, the eyes, the ears vibrate with this contact, this relational contact, this aggregate of seeing and hearing and bodily sensing and mind contact all at once. This kind of operating, this movement of this acute sensitivity of the organism. So all of the perceptions then that begin to be known, not just, maybe not just the subtlety of sensations or the mental touch, the visual touch, the auditory touch, but also, it's a human being, it's a man, skin color like this, and so on. But then at the same moment, the vibrating of the body mind with that, lifetime of response. Oh, I know what this is. Liking, not liking. So relational contact built on this sensitivity. So this relational sensitivity that vibrates with the totality of our history. Every prior contact conditions this moment. And all that that implies, every prior contact, for example, with teachers. Is this guy a teacher? It's a pretty complex construct. Every prior contact, if this is a relevant one for you, with men. Is this patriarchy in action? Can I escape the chemistry of my own patriarchy? My whiteness, my skin color? My age? Your response? He's this age. And it sort of comes up. How can I, this organism, how can I be safe find pleasure, avoid pain, stabilize myself in this sensitive, changing world right now. So moment by moment, this contact, feeling, perception, it's this, the world is like this, here's these objects, there's some Buddhas over there, oh, Buddhas, oh, there's a flower, oh, flowers, oh, there's a man, I don't know about that, oh, there's, you know, light, there's this voice, there's Dhamma, mind contact with Dhamma. Whoa, this is beautiful to notice in this elemental way. Wow, how beautiful the Dhamma is. And that's like that. Each moment conditioned by all prior moments. And because this organism has been in all prior moments, so sensitive and so relationally sensitive, that all prior moments of consciousness are conditioned by that relational sensitivity. Even when you're not with people, you're out in the forest, you're alone on a city street. Do you feel alone or lonely? Do you feel the pressures of society? Do you feel like you have to do something or become something? So all those are all relationally conditioned pressures. Who I am, not just in the abstract, but in the world. Wow. So here we are. Each moment of contact conditioned by all prior contacts with the natural world, the human-made world, with humans. So each moment is conditioned, put it some ways that are simple, albeit a little bit cliched, but right now, your mother, my mother, is present. That's just how it is. My father, your father, is present. All the people that you've loved and hated. So sensitive. And this is the world, right? So this is how it go on. So there's contact based on these sense organs, the actual eyes and ears in a world, contact, mental contact is part of that. Feeling, pleasant and unpleasant, and perceptions happening. And then there's all the wanting the unpleasant to go away, wanting the pleasant to come and stay. And so we learn, wow, as an organism, like this incredible brain, body, mind thing, learning the world, how do I locate the pleasant? How do I get more of it? Everybody wants to be happy, as they say. Everybody wants pleasant sensations. The organism, you don't have to think you want it. The organism craves the pleasant sensations, the food, the sex, the beauty, the ending of the unpleasant. Get away from that terrible noise. I'll pay more if I can get a house or an apartment away from the traffic. I will, dress myself in these kinds of clothing so that I can stay warm or stay cool. Oh, and by the way, so I can look good, so that you'll like me, so I can feel good. So I develop strategies for that. Oh, I want the pleasure. I want to avoid the pain. And we're so clever. The whole organism gives itself over to this from the time we're infants, figuring it out as teenagers. How do I do this? And the strategies, the baked-in strategies of we adults, or whatever we're supposed to be. So there's a kind of a drive, a longing, an urge for these certain perceptions and feelings. And they're expressing themselves relationally as well as in relationship to cappuccino and scones and tea and whatever. We have strategies for scones that are different from our strategy for love. It's all the same thing. The urging of this sensitive organism. Get what's pleasurable, stay from what, keep away the pain, and survive. How can I survive? How can I actually land in this world at this, all these senses, all this complexity, all these desires and fears? It's so much. How do I cope with this sensitivity? And that's where I begin to freeze the world in these perceptions and constructions. So I begin to see you just as that clump of a thing. This is what I was saying earlier, these cliches, like these, you know, fixations. But we're fixating what's fluid. Nothing is fixed. It's all just as empty and constantly changing as you notice when you meditate. It's always like that. We just don't notice it, right? And here we're trying to fix it so we can, I can stabilize this me. And here I am in the center. Okay, I can take a little rest with that one for now. Right? I can rest with this. This is okay, stable now. And then how do we stabilize? How do we, you know, the world is constantly changing. We can't really rest. So constantly looking for that stabilizing of the world, like, oh. And not only do I stabilize with my objects, have a drink of water. That's good. I can take a little rest on that pleasurable experience. I can have a drink of you, and you can have a drink of me, so we can meet and we can stabilize each other. How are you? Are you good? And you say to me, oh, I'm okay. Oh, good. I'm glad you're good. So the natural sensitive response, just as I'm sensitive to flowers and smog and beauty and ugliness, I'm sensitive to you. And so when you're in pain, I vibrate with that pain. When you feel joy, I naturally vibrate with that joy. But sometimes it's too much. I learn to shut it out. But then again, I still need enough of it to stabilize. To like, oh yeah, you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. You okay? Yeah, okay. Okay, so we can stabilize each other a little bit. But don't come too far in, because then it's dangerous. I don't know if it's safe. But meanwhile, you know, how can I, you know, find the love and care that this organism has always needed to stabilize and be happy in the world? It's not an add-on. It's intrinsic to the organism, this relational quality. There is no such thing as a single human. There is no such thing as an understanding of the mind when you look only at a single mind. Gregory Bateson observed this in applying systems theory to the human psychology. The Buddha saw it, you know, a couple thousand years ago, noticing that spiritual friendship is the whole of the holy life, the value of spiritual friendship, and if in the absence of that, that the path can't evolve. Because he was saying the same thing. There's no path that's an individual path. Right now, we're on this path. And it's this human sensitivity that's making possible this mind-to-mind transmission. The voice of another, wise attention, you listening, the conditions for the arising of right view, of wisdom, of understanding Dhamma, they're the necessary conditions. So there's no path alone, not possible. But more than that, this sensitivity towards the protection and the fear and the wanting, and the sensitivity of compassion, of love, where the organism can settle. But still, we have this, you know, ongoing problem, right? Of thirst. I'm thirsty for pleasure. I'm thirsty for stabilizing myself and you so you can become not just I'm compassion, feeling compassion for you. It's all about me and stabilizing my me. You can see this in the extreme in people who are, let's say, narcissists or, you know, have other kinds of mental obsessions that you just become an object in their lives to for them to try to fill this incredibly painful hole of instability. The Buddhist words for this in Pali, this was bhava, tanha, the thirst, the hunger, the craving to become, to exist, to stabilize the self. Oh my God, constant project. But I'm glad I got you to take care of it, to help me stabilize me. I don't really care about you. Let's stabilize me. And I stabilize myself in my whiteness, and I have my privilege in my, perhaps my maleness, my manness. I stabilize myself in my money and my power. When I have my power, I have my money, I really feel strong and stable and protected. And I stabilize, I use my power to get pleasures that also not only bring me the rush of sensory pleasure, they bring me this stabilized sense of self. So I go out and I buy things with my money and power. And it's never enough, but I don't know that. More and more and more. Next thing you know, the earth is stripped of resources because I want to have lots of clothing, nice houses, automobiles, shelter that's expensive and inefficient, and, you know, on and on. You can look around you and see the result of this thirst for pleasure building with the thirst for stabilizing, for creating, protecting the self, for becoming. And I can't have power alone. I have to have power over you is my preferred, but maybe power with you over other people. So then we bond together against the world, against these other people. And all of this sensitivity now is put in service of greed, hatred, delusion. It's put in service of filling the hunger. So now this natural bonding quality, this even the compassion and the sensitivity is small and limited, but it's still sensitive in there that you and I, we can be really good friends. We can love each other and then go attack those people over there, right? And get their stuff, take their oil, take their diamonds, take their coffee and bananas and sugar. Pleasure, becoming, going from our relationship out to the larger system and manifesting systemically this same sensitivity and these same urges that we've been talking about the whole time, relationally expressed, socially and culturally expanded to a system that's thirsty and insatiable. It will never be enough for me, for us, for all. It's never enough because the organism will keep vibrating and wanting. And the incredible insight of the Buddha carried in the Dhamma is that, like, that will never work. That will always lead to suffering. And there's a turning, it says. Rather than try to find happiness that way, I'm going to release, let go, and find the happiness that comes with peace. And the same sensitivity as peace evolves, that very same sensitivity now that's always operating, even when you're callous and hurt and greedy, you're still sensitive. Now the same sensitivity is operating with compassion. It's now I'm not at the center. I'm not holding and trying to stabilize this self. I'm even letting go of self, self-fixation. It's a remarkable vision, this third noble truth of cooling, of ending, of cessation. That's what it's talking about. That's what's getting cooled in this very life at the deepest possible level. That's why stillness is so helpful. Stillness individually. Or touch something that is not hungry and say, oh, wow, that quality of dwelling, that quality of not wanting, that is pleasurable. The bliss of peacefulness, of cessation. It was one of the lessons I really got from cancer. It's like, wow. Non-pain. And the body vibrates with bliss, really. It's in there. I was able to find it because after years of pain and nausea and all that, it's like, wow. Just a dwelling without that. It's like that relationally. There's always tension trying to be someone, to something, to become something, and imagine a relationship where that even for a moment of meditation together, you might touch a calming, you pause, you remain open and aware, and you touch a moment of relational contact that's simply empty of longing and fear. And all of that relational conditioning that's built into your hormones, into the structure of your brain, into your body, into all of the mental, psychological conditioning, all of that stuff can let go. Because there's, you know, just known to be empty for that moment, right? We're talking about a moment. I'm not building a utopia here. But when you touch it, you know it's possible. You know that quality of relationship, of relatedness, just like a relation with the world, with nature, you become sensitive to the totality of the natural world. And that natural world includes these other beings. Here we are together in this dwelling. And it's just like the body without pain. You know, it's very beautiful. We've come to normalize stress, tension, fear. It's normal. It's what we call normal. Dukkha, Pali word, fancy word for pain. Always trying to stabilize that self. Oh my God, what a project. Pause. In Insight Dialogue, you learn to pause, relax and receive, and open, and be in this emergent experience and just yield to it, listen to it. And here's where we speak and listen. And you can experience something different where that sensitivity is not driven by thirst. The formulation in the discourses that you most often come about of freedom, formulation of freedom that you see most often of liberation, the indication. It's not some heavenly sphere. It's not something out of this life. It's straight ahead and blunt. The ending of the intoxicants, the effluence, the sewage, the evil spirits of, you know, that which would intoxicate you no longer flow. So that's specifically, you know, named as like this constant urging for pleasure, constant urging for becoming, that keep each other going, that we talked about, with power and identity and systems and everything, that no longer flows, and the ignorance, the intoxication of ignorance, just no longer flows. You see that, you see it. So the ending of the intoxicants, the asava, the taints, the effluence, that's it. That's the cessation. That's the third noble truth in the most oft expressed way in the discourses. But, you know, ehipasiko, you come and see for yourself. You try it out. What's possible in this very life, in this sensitive, relationally formed life embedded in human systems? What's possible? And that is the place, that is the source of wise action. Like in Insight Dialogue, when you come to this guideline, speak the truth. Speak the truth is really to act in the world. Listen deeply. What's going on here? Speak the truth. And that truth can be informed by an experience of beauty, an experience of peace. It can be informed by your direct contact with the sacred, you might say, the mystery of things that is revealed when this, like the noise clears for even a moment. We're still sensitive, of course, but we're not ignorant. That's a human possibility. And that sensitive kind of knowing the world is to know the world with compassion for all creatures, humans, animals, insects, birds, reptiles, fish, the invisible creatures, the unknown, because you're sensitive. It's simply bare responsiveness with wisdom. So this is a good time then, I'm adhering to the form, this is a good time for the Q&A, I guess they call it. I'll also let you know that this talk is, you might say, the preparation for a half-day teaching that I'll be offering in early November through Sangha Live, where we'll actually drop into insight dialogue practice. So please only come if you're ready to do breakout rooms and so on. We'll touch what we can of, you know, pausing into this simplicity of experience. Like I said, early November. So we'll do the Q&A now. Thank you. I'm trusting that George will guide this somehow, or something will happen. There seems to be an ask a question printed somewhere. No, there is no question yet, is there? Nope. Okay, oh, very good. We can sit here being sensitive. If we're going to be anyway, we may as well acknowledge it, recognize it. Someone extends gratitude. That's sweet. See, so that movement of kindness to say the gratitude, you may feel it, but then to also share it with me is a act of kindness and generosity. And so it's the human relational quality in action. We have so many beautiful qualities within us, don't we? One says, I don't see a way to ask a question. Two questions and ask the question. I guess I'm not seeing them. Well, maybe I'm not doing this correctly. I can accept that. I have clicked on ask a question, and all I have is a couple of comments. How do we deal with people who are unaccustomed to receiving authentic gratitude and compassion? That is, people who are hurt and therefore cynical. Yeah. And the question generally of, we live in a world where most people are closed and defended. And it's good to remember, closed and defended with good reason, right? They've been hurt, and often hurt repeatedly, possibly even traumatized. And Can we remember that when we want to either be there for them in some way or express these pleasant things like, you know, gratitude and kindness? If you can find that remembrance of their sensitivity and their, like, this sensitive organism has reacted to the world in a way that has been painful so many times, that what you're really seeing in them is this calloused exterior that they've built up to protect this tenderness inside. And that includes all of these quite horrific politicians and people who really, we would say, are really bad players in the world. It's all the same thing. Every single person is functioning from this sensitivity and trying to get pleasure and avoid pain and stabilize the self. But in so doing, circumstances have created all of these strategies of protection and fear. And so now when we encounter them, or we encounter the systems that we participate in together, it's like we're running into those crystallizations of that pain, whether it's the way the economic system is so unjust and so on. Well, it's all an expression, isn't it, of that greed for pleasure. People are trying to get the money, the power themselves to have the pleasure, whether it's at the level of yachts and skyscrapers and so on, or if it's simply at the level of, you know, some smaller little bits of pleasure that you can get by being a member of a gang on a street corner. Got to get it somehow. Got to avoid the pain, got to stabilize the self. Oh, I'll join a gang. And now I'm a closed, hardened person because I'm surrounded by pain. I'm creating pain for others, but still inside there's this incredible sensitivity, the same that you and I experience, exactly the same, but with all of these constructs on top of it that are so tangled and painful. And it's like, wow. So can we remember that? Can we allow the compassion and offer what we can and ourselves be aware that as I express my care and compassion, that there are within me some hungers, right? Like I want to have that acknowledged. It stabilizes my sense of self. It makes me feel good about things. Like I'm, you know, putting my efforts out wisely. I'm being seen and heard. Things that, you know, we continue to be human, in other words. So we pause, notice the body, mind functioning, relax and receive, allow this to be as it is, and offer the best compassion that we can. Being tender with ourselves too, of course. If we keep at it and keep bumping our heads against hardness, at some point we might want to stop. That's very tempting and sometimes appropriate. There's a question about handling adversities from, you know, whatever. The way I'm reading the question from ID and the teachings, meaning from insight dialogue and from the Dhamma, what does it offer to you about handling adversity? Well, I'll start with simply this perspective that can come when whatever is going on, there's that moment, slight moment of a pause. That would be the insight dialogue kind of language. But let's just say a moment of mindfulness where you can recognize the reaction to what's going on, and how that becomes a forest fire of its own. So, for example, you have chronic pain, or you have chemotherapy, or you just got bad news, a bad diagnosis, or a friend has just died, or you know, something terrible has just happened in your family, whatever. And in comes the information. And again, let's tap back down to this base level of our sensitivity. So I'm very sensitive, and I'm relationally sensitive too. Remember that. And I get this news that, you know, my child has gotten hurt or died, or something's happened to someone I love elsewhere. And the immediate, you know, kind of whole body mind response is, you know, going to be this combination of, you know, how it vibrates through all your constructs. Oh no, this is terrible. What a loss. Fearful of what might come next. Oh my God, they're hurt. Are they going to die? Are they going to be okay? And projecting out to the future, that is what we do as animals, you know, as intelligent human being type animals. It's like we say, okay, what are the possible scenarios? And we go, we start living in those scenarios. And at the same time, we're living in our own scenarios of our possible loneliness if this person dies, or what's it going to be like to live the rest of my life with cancer, or whatever it is. We're living in the scenario of that. And those various forest fires will burn hot, and they will keep burning. But that moment of sati, that moment of mindfulness, is a moment of seeing things in this very bare, direct way. There's a tremendous amount of love inherent in clear awareness, meaning that the responsive organism is inclined, when it's able, to just receive, let in, and then the natural response of care is what happens. And that's for yourself, and that's also for other beings. And the getting in touch with that in that moment of letting go, the identification with the whole forest fire, with this kind of what I sometimes call a descent into hell, right? That you can immediately fall into the pit of hell when this, as you say, adversity, you know, which is the comment is correct. I have experienced a lot of that kind of stuff. It's been a powerful teacher. Do you want to go to hell? Do you want to spend your life in hell? Or can things be as they are, which is not as you want them, and they're scary and, you know, all that, but they're just what they are. Ah, here it is. There's this body. And even if there's pain, or even if there's a, you know, the ongoing experiencing in the background of the body mind, the fear of this, my son may die, or my daughter did die, or my this, you know, all the things that I've experienced. It's like, right now, it's just this. Can I open to that? And in that opening to it, I didn't know this at the time. I was really focused on the awareness aspect, and the awareness aspect was absolutely stabilizing without a question. But I now realize that in that moment of awareness, in that pause, if you will, there's a tremendous, the Brahmaviharas in Buddhist language, there's a tremendous love, a compassionate response, and even the availability to joy, even in those times of difficulty. So can I remember? Now, I'll say that's one of the reasons to meditate now, before all the pits of hell open around you. Get a little bit of prep work under your belt. And all I mean by that is, can you locate awareness? Can you touch the love? Can you touch the compassion that's in it? And you don't have to have any perfect practice at all. My practice is not so perfect, right? But you get to where you can recognize that luminosity of the mind, and just that that quality of being aware that's not clinging, not fixated and attached. If you can touch it for a moment, and then you'll fall in again. Touch it for a moment, you'll fall in again and again. And can you keep doing that until it becomes known and begins to stabilize? And then it can be there even as the world is falling apart. That's a capacity that we have. Now, I have to say that we're not ever doing this alone. So do you have spiritual friends that you can turn to? People who may or may not be Buddhist in their nature of their friendship. Can you allow their presence to be with you? Can you get enough out of hell to pull yourself enough out of the blackness of the fabrications that you've just grabbed onto, dove into, and here's this other person who's like not in hell offering a stabilizing presence? Now, if they have a dumb background or if they have a meditation background and that presence is truly, you know, stabilized in that way. And of course, many people have this great gift of a natural compassion and care, stabilize in that. That becomes a beacon, not only a comforting, but also a stabilizing in the sense, in a Buddhist sense, kind of an emptiness, awareness, knowing the impermanence, and so on. Considering the notion of intrinsic interrelationship with conditions, that is, dependent arising, corresponds to the notion of personal or individualized letting go and surrender to various external circumstances. You know, the angle on this, I don't know if this is going to address what's being spoken here, but it seems to be hinging on this, what I state it this way, this paradox, actually, a genuine paradox, not a casual paradox. The human being is intrinsically individual. And the human being is intrinsically relational. Okay? They're both true. So, okay, here's this skull. Inside the skull is a brain. This brain is connected through all kinds of amazing stuff to this whole body. And all these organs with all the intelligence and the neurotransmitters in the heart and the gut, it's all happening. And it's all in here. And the world is being fabricated. And Gregory thinks it's like this. And Gregory's talking like he knows what he's talking about. And he really doesn't. And it's like, oh, well, here I am creating a universe and kind of functioning in this universe with you. But, and you'll never know what it's like in here. You never, right? It's like all my background, all my stuff, and so on. And I go around the world and carry this with me. Wow, that's pretty individual. All, I've got all these aggregates, you know, consciousness and feelings and perceptions. It seems very individual. Dependent origination, we were going through it with our practice earlier. You know, you have the sense bases and you have contact, feeling, craving, clinging, becoming, like, wow, that's all right here, right? And very individual. At the same time, every moment of consciousness is conditioned by all prior volitional contacts, sankhara, pachaya, vijnana. All those prior moments of contact includes my whole, relational, not only my internal relational experience, but all my prior relational contacts are conditioning every moment of experience mentally, right? And this whole organism is the whole psychobiology of it is relationally structured. It's how the brain, you know, the conditions in the environment were included, the social conditions for evolution. And that's a very powerful fact. Just like living in the jungle is a powerful fact, so is living with other humans. That's how we survived as a species. So that's all built in too. And there isn't a moment that's not relationally conditioned, not one. So yeah, you got these two together, and Paticca-Samuppada, independent origination, is unfolding in here. It's unfolding between us, and it's unfolding and manifesting systemically, continually. And the world seems like this, impermanent, empty, functioning in a causal way. Not just individually, but as a soup, as a system. And those larger systems lead out. I touch on this several times in my book, Whole Life Path. You'll see it coming through because it's like built in to how we live the Noble Eightfold Path, how we live as decent, caring human beings on a path of liberation. So I hope that that addresses your question at least a little bit. I should go up to the top. Thank you so much. I've been a practitioner most of my life, but I have not heard the teachings expressed this way before. Here is my question. How do we cope with traumatic relationships buried deep in our past, which still cause us to dissociate and project onto others? Oh, I know. Yeah, we really do that. I think that's my first simple suggestion is, you know, you seem to clearly recognize this. And I urge all of us to a tremendous amount of patience and receptivity around our own conditioned nature. I've heard it said in Christianity, our own brokenness. But there's nothing intrinsically broken. There's still this sensitivity, and that it, you know, those dissociating events and conditions, you know, come up so strongly. Can we know them? Can we know them? And I'll say here again what I hinted at earlier. This path of coming to know the human experience as it actually is you know, this beautiful whole life path, moment by moment of, you know, the kind of reconditioning the conditioned and releasing the conditioning to the extent possible, which is this practice of loving awareness, basically. And this is not work that happens alone, or shall we say, it happens both internally and individually, and it very much happens in spiritual friendship and in community. Because what happens in community and with spiritual friends is that we can see things that we cannot see alone, either because they don't come out, like I don't have anyone to be scared of, so I'm not going to become aware of my fear or hatred or aversion or stereotypes and biases. I won't have a chance to recognize it, right? So that's the challenge. That's why you're often go into silence and individuality on a long silent retreat, because like, wow, it's a lot of stuff to deal with. But so you'll see stuff that you won't see in part because it's triggered, but also because in the presence of another, especially specifically, actually, someone who is compassionate, receptive, patient, it becomes possible to stabilize enough to bring awareness to those dark and hurt places that are too painful or too destabilizing to go alone. So let's say you're an insight dialogue practice and you're taking one of the classic Buddhist contemplations on, let's say, death, or on, let's take death. And you might be able to touch that at a level that you can't touch alone, because you're, you might say, borrowing or co-regulating the samadhi, the calm, the settledness of mind in the compassionate, you know, between, in the stable awareness that you create together with two, three, four, or whatever. And so it is with these traumatic relationships that the questioner spoke about that are buried deep, right? That we can maybe touch what we can't touch otherwise. And insight dialogue practice is not intended to be a psychotherapy practice in the sense of contemporary psychology, but in the sense of the Buddhist psychology, it is, absolutely. You know, where one recognizes the arising of these constructions that have been built for so long, meets them, sati is there, mindfulness is there, the loving awareness is there, and this is, just begins to be enough stability that maybe I can touch and allow in a way that I can't alone. And meanwhile, and I'll leave it with this, the path is not just one of meditation, whether it's insight dialogue or, you know, individual silent meditation. It's not just one of all these austere practices, but how do we live the whole of our lives? Because these buried traumas, or even if, you know, traumas is like an extreme kind of a hard nut that we can look at pretty easily. But think of all the other constructs that we carry, the ignorances, the biases, the fears, the desires, and so on, that are constantly, you know, dominating this sensitive organism. It's like, this is how I respond to the world, right? So the whole of our lives is a process of moving in the direction of feeding that, or the path of relinquishment, of cessation, of letting go, of knowing, receiving, releasing. And so that's why, you know, sila, morality, is central to it, because it's a constant practice of decentering the self and caring for others and being safe and decent in the world, caring for the whole, all beings, the whole society, for everyone you meet. It's a practice, it's a way of being. How you live your life in your home, how you consume, what you consume, the Buddha's teachings on the requisites of the robes and the food and the medicines that you need to live. But do you really want to lard your life up with what a consumer society has said you need to protect and stabilize the self and provide all those pleasures that then gum up and you can't see these constructs at work? So it's a whole life thing, right? It's not just special practices. So that's really important and beautiful. So much more. But we're near the end here. Oh, what a great question. Sensitive as being something negative. Oh, I know. But we're all sensitive. Everybody's sensitive. And there's no choice about it. It's not negative or positive. It's being born. You know, as they say in Zen, being born, already a mistake. You know, you got this sensitive body mind. That's how it is. Now what? Let's be skillful. So in closing, I'll just remind us that there's a half day of teaching in early November. And I'll also say that I'll thank Sangha Live again. And I don't know how this works, but my PayPal account, gregory@meta.org at PayPal, is how that works. I don't know what they have going. And what really matters now is how we, you know, live this, how we support each other in living this. You can go to insightdialogue.org and find more talks, more practice opportunities. That's really good if you feel drawn to a relational understanding of the Dhamma, of the human experience. So may all beings benefit from our time together. There's so much suffering in the world, and this is our participation to reduce suffering for ourselves and for all beings, near and far, being seen and unseen, born and yet to be born. May all beings be free. May there be peace. May there be peace. May there be peace. Oh, thank you, beings. Wishing you well.